Welcome to the Weekend Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We wake up on a Friday morning. Where do you even start with all of this? Minneapolis is burning. Another 2.1 million Americans filed for unemployment. More than 102,000 Americans have died from the coronavirus. And we get a lot more performative Trumpism. We have Trump's tweet on Friday morning, where that was actually removed by Twitter for violating its standards for glorifying violence. And that came just a day after Trump issued a bizarre executive order threatening a government crackdown on social media sites. He's apparently found a form of administrative regulation that he, in fact, loves. So quick note, by the way, I want to thank all the listeners of the Bulwark Podcast. It looks like May is going to be a record number of downloads. We easily passed a million downloads for the month of May. And earlier this week, one of our more popular podcasts, we had Tom Nichols on, and to talk about his piece in The Atlantic, where he talked about the unmanliness of Donald Trump. And I'm pretty sure that that was the article that triggered the president's tweets about The Atlantic. So congratulations all around. And speaking of The Atlantic, we are joined by a longtime contributor, and I've been a big fan of Connor Friedersdorf for years, have been stealing his stuff, have been quoting his stuff, have been tweeting his stuff. And I think this is the first time that he joins us on the Bulwark Podcast. So good to talk with you, Connor.
Good to be here.
Now, what was it? Was it the Tom Nichols piece that triggered the attack on The Atlantic?
One can never know, but it seemed like it was.
Yeah, the president, of course, in the midst of all of this, taking time out to celebrate people losing their job. But then, of course, the president takes time out to talk about a lot of things, including Joe Scarborough. And I want to get to that in a moment. You had a great piece about Rush Limbaugh, and I want to talk about that in a little moment. But let's talk about the riots, what's happening right now. And the way that the president is reacting to all of this. You have a new piece up today about his looting tweet. This was the one where he's apparently, he talks about these thugs are dishonoring the memory of George Floyd. I won't let that happen. Just spoke to the governor, told him the military is with him all the way. Any difficulty and we will assume control, but, and here's the phrase, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. What's the president doing here?
Well, among other things, beyond pouring gasoline on the fire at exactly the wrong moment, he is suggesting something, shooting looters on site, that is unconstitutional. It's, you may have this phrase bouncing around in your memory. I do. I think it's from old documentaries. Looters will be shot on sight coming out of the speakers of National Guard trucks. And in 1985, the Supreme Court, had this case where it basically adjudicated when can lethal force be used when the officer is not in fear of his or her life or in fear of imminent danger to the public. And the answer was, not then. They can't just shoot someone who is stealing something who is unarmed and not threatening anyone. And so that standard, Trump is sworn to protect and defend the Constitution. In this case, he's not doing that. He is urging something that was clearly found by the Supreme Court to violate the Fourth Amendment.
Okay, so I forget. Are we supposed to take him literally or seriously, or seriously but not literally in any case? This is just more performative Trumpism, though, right? Isn't he sort of just signaling that he's the law and order candidate and essentially staking his flag on which side of urban disorder he is on? Remember, he's the law and order president, right?
Yeah, it's hard to know whatever motivates anything that he says exactly. We can't see into his mind. But we do know that he is the president of the United States. He's the commander in chief. He's talking about sending the National Guard to Minnesota. And there are people in that outfit with guns who may take what the president says seriously. And so whatever his intentions, he has a responsibility to speak a lot more responsibly than he does, because regardless of his intentions, his words have an effect.
So the provenance of the language is interesting. George Wallace used that phrase, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. And apparently, though, he borrowed this from a notorious police chief from Miami who used it back in 1967. And one of these guys who would brag that he didn't care whether they were accused of police brutality. So there's a specific history to the phrase that he used. So, but what did you think about Twitter's decision to take it down?
Well, did they take it down, or did they note this violates our terms?
Okay, that's true. Okay.
Right. So I was glad that they left it up and said, you know, I don't really care if they say this violates our terms or if they say, you know, we're going to fact check this. I'm skeptical that any of that will do any good. But I do think that if they would have taken it down, they would have taken down a newsworthy thing.
Okay, no, I stand corrected. I'm reading what they wrote there. The tweet violated the Twitter rules about glorifying violence. However, Twitter has determined it may be in the public's interest for the tweet to remain accessible. In other words, if the president's going to behave like this, we're going to expose him. It's interesting that the White House is pushing back, you know, all in saying, well, then are you going to do this about the Ayatollah Khomeini? What about other foreign leaders who seem to be, quote unquote, glorifying violence? Is this one of those things where Twitter, I think, did the right thing, but is going to find itself sort of chasing the rabbit down the hole?
You know, that may be. I don't even know that the tweet necessarily glorified violence beyond a reasonable doubt. Did it glorify it or did it just threaten it? You know, it's hard to say. My wish, it's probably something that will never happen. My wish is that, most people would just be allowed to say what they will on Twitter, unless it's a really extreme case, and that world leaders would just be kicked off Twitter, like all world leaders, all presidents, both parties. And I really do think that it is a uniquely dangerous medium, for world leaders. It's this off the cuff kind of stuff. You know, it's somewhat vulnerable to hacking, and so you could get in the case of a world leader's account getting hacked and then saying something that caused some kind of irrevocable damage or harm. These people all have huge platforms anyway. They can reach anyone. I don't know if their unfiltered and impulsive thoughts is an improvement on the past when they had to have a little bit of a hurdle before they spoke to the public. And so I think if I was, you know, if I was king of Twitter, I might say it's the people's platform and these politicians can go elsewhere to talk. But in the world that we're in, I think that Twitter just has a bunch of bad choices and that they're going to have a really hard time moderating in any kind of consistent way at the scale that they're at.
You know, it's been an extraordinary week because we started off thinking, well, 2020, of course, is going to be dominated by one major story. It's going to be dominated by the coronavirus and the economic fallout from the coronavirus. And now you're looking at pictures of Minneapolis burning and the disorder across the country. And that has just blocked out all of the discussion. And it's like we got to the 100,000 death milestone. And it's like, okay, now we're moving on to the next big issue. So Susan Glasser has an interesting tweet. I wanted you to react to it. She says, 2020 started out like 1974, then switched, obviously reference to Watergate and the impeachment, then switched to some horrible combination of 1918, the big Spanish flu, the pandemic, and 1929, of course, with the crash. So, yeah, we started off to look like it was going to be, you know, presidential impeachment. Then we switched to, you know, the coronavirus, 1918, a 1929-like crash. Now it feels like 1968. Ugh. It does. It's like all the planets coming together in the same news cycle.
It really is. I mean, the pace of news for certainly the entire Trump era and probably even before that, it's hard to process it all. And it's hard for people like you and I who pay really close attention on a day-to-day basis to even understand what it's like for people who aren't paying very close attention and whether they're finding this sense that history is speeded up as much as people who are paying attention to all the events or not. And the attention span seemed to be short. So who knows a month from now what year we'll be in. You know, Mickey Kouse for years has been writing about the Filer Faster thesis, he calls it. I think that the guy who coined it was named Filer. And it's basically just the idea that people have been processing information more quickly. And, you know, you used to talk about an October surprise coming right before the election. And now it kind of has to be a late October surprise, because who remembers what happened the first week of October on election day? It'll be interesting to see whether we're still talking about these riots, when we get to debates between Donald Trump and Joe Biden.
That's a great point. I mean, I think I remember joking on this podcast during the impeachment. I'll say, you know, you realize there's going to become a moment in May where you're going to look back on the impeachment and say, does anybody remember impeachment? And then we'd all laugh. Ha, ha, ha. And it's like, wow. It's like we were saying that in March. So you had an interest. Let's talk about the they are riots that are breaking out. And I have to tell you, and I know that you are a student of how conservatives react to things and how middle America reacts to things. And, you know, I'm watching the riots and I am having these flashbacks to the late 1960s, including, you know, some of the intellectualizing and rationalizing and condoning of this violence. And I thought you had an interesting tweet last night. I'll read you your own tweet. Those with the remove and the privilege to conceive of riots as abstract symbols of righteous dissent rather than nightmares that burn your neighborhood where your loved ones live and work should listen to voices like, and then you link to the president of the St. Paul NAACP, who is describing what the riots are liking. I do think that there's a moment here where, I mean, is it hard for progressives to say, look, we need to focus on the terrible injustice of this death of this black man at the hands of police, but the riots are tragedies. They are indefensible, and people are completely justified in being outraged by them. Is that hard for them to say?
It seems to be. That tweet got tremendous pushback from progressives on Twitter, and it's supposed to be in the mind of woke progressives, the best thing that you can do as a white man on Twitter, right, is to amplify a woman of color, a leader in the NAACP, for that matter. It turns out that when that person isn't echoing the progressive line on a thing, that is no longer an enlightened thing. It is an unenlightened thing. I come to this, I grew up in Southern California. I was a newspaper reporter in Southern California. I lived in New York City for a while. In both places, I talked to people who had been there on the scene of different riots and described them. And in New York, it was at a senior center in Harlem. It was all African Americans. In DC, or I'm sorry, in LA, it was Korean Americans. It was African Americans. It was Latinos. Everyone I've ever talked to who has had a business burned down, who has even had fires in their neighborhood, describe it as a terrifying experience, a traumatic experience. People who were kids were frightened. People who had neighbors who were traumatized were frightened. And the economic devastation lasts for years. There's lots of scholarship showing this. And, the retort to that is, oh, well, you're worried about buildings, economic devastation. Right. No, it's small businesses. It's property values of African-American homeowners, losing equity. It's all kinds of personal human costs. And just a vanishingly small percentage of people who have actually been through this or have had this happen in their own neighborhoods glory in it. The vast majority will say this was an awful tragedy. And it is frustrating to me remembering all of those interviews across the years, some with people who had moved out of Los Angeles, out to the Inland Empire because of the 92 riots, to just see it portrayed as the only choice or the response of everyone in the community when it's a vanishingly small percentage of people in the community who are responding in this way is really frustrating.
And to underline your point, there was one story that I saw this morning about a center for collecting Native American history that apparently was burned and completely destroyed. And all of this history, all of the efforts that they had made, wiped out in this sort of orgy of violence. And I'm sorry, then I turn on one of the cable stations, which you can probably guess which one, and they're saying, well, we shouldn't really focus on this because we're just talking about broken glass as opposed to human life, and you can put the glass back up. And that seemed to be to be a little bit tone deaf about what's actually happening. Also, and you touched on this, if you want to go back and understand the divide in this country, the urban-rural divide, the red-blue divide, a lot of that traces back to the late 1960s and these riots and the way that various factions responded to them. And I think those scars, those political scars, lasted a long time. And I think people underestimate the way this is playing out politically in a lot of ways, even though, and I agree with you that, I mean, Donald Trump's tweet this morning was absolutely horrific and a violation of his oath. But this plays into his hand. He would much rather be talking about this right now than anything involving the coronavirus
or the economy.
It's
a gift to him. It's not a coincidence that he is taking it up and talking about it. And you know, the frequent retort when this subject comes up is Nixon was reelected, and we could see that again.
Yeah, and this is a flag. So there, we often debate whether there's method to his madness. In this one, even though he is rightly being criticized for tweeting out a racist meme, there is this reptilian cunning and instinct that he has here that and he knows how this is going to play in the white rural base. And frankly, I have to say that this is one of those issues where it can't be that hard for Democratic politicians to say, yes, let's focus intensely on what we are learning about the way that Black men are being treated by police. Let's treat that injustice seriously, but let's also make sure that we understand the importance of defending society against this kind of violence. I don't know why that is so difficult, and I think that there is a real political risk here. Okay, I want to move on to this, but I want to get onto a number of things, including the Joe Scarborough thing, which is a distraction from a distraction from a distraction. But, all of this comes the day after the president issues this, I'm sorry, this Orwellian executive order about social media companies. And I don't know whether you've had a chance to actually read the executive order. I mean, it reads like a parody of itself. I mean, it reads like a stream of consciousness tweet storm from the president talking about Adam Schiff and anything. But coming from a conservative Republican going after a private company, calling for vast expansion of the regulation of social media is incredible. And watching somebody like Ted Cruz, Ted Cruz, who has been dining out as a constitutional purist and scholar for years, is defending all of this in a way that exposes his fundamental misunderstanding of the Section 203 and of the First Amendment. And he is just being, even as we speak, just absolutely schooled on social media by people like Charlie Cook from National Review and others. So what's with Trump here and what's with Cruz?
To say that Cruz misunderstands it is the most generous possible interpretation. It would be shocking to me if, given his history in law and the kinds of things and speeches I've seen him give and say, the kinds of events he's done, if he understood it as poorly as he is representing himself on Twitter right now, and arguing with Charles C.W. Mm-hmm. Cook at National Review, who is just schooling him on this.
Yeah.
Trump. I don't know. I think that Trump is erring in his instinct here. I do think that there is popular discontent with social media. I also think that there's popular discontent with Trump being on Twitter. A lot of Trump supporters that I talk to who defend him on almost everything else say, I wish this guy would stop tweeting or tweet a little bit less. It is only the hardest core of the hardcore of super online Trump supporters who really want him on that platform and revel in it. And I do think that that notion that he's a little bit obsessed with Twitter in an unhealthy way, combined with picking this particular fight with a pandemic going on, with cities burning, we're basically seeing the American carnage that he said he would stop, right? We have 100,000 people dead. We have rioting in multiple cities. And he's picking Twitter fights and writing executive orders, and it has to turn off anyone who has an ounce of principle left. It undercuts the notion that the Republican Party is the party of free speech. I mean, I know it's representing itself as a pro-free speech thing, but it's very clearly trying to take the hand of the government and impinge on a private company because Trump doesn't like the way that it treated him personally, and that's so transparent. So I think that his obsession is getting the better of him here. And the weird thing is that if he won the fight and if they got rid of Section 230, Donald Trump would be among the first and biggest losers, right?
Oh, I mean, look, I mean, Section 230 essentially says that the platforms are not liable for, you know, for the content that other parties post on the site. I'm simplifying.
Yeah.
Okay. So if, in fact, you get rid of 230, what happens is that then Twitter and Facebook and everybody else becomes responsible for the things that Donald Trump himself posts. And so if Donald Trump was writing something that is completely libelous and slanderous, like, hey, Joe Scarborough, which we're going to talk about in a minute, there's no publication in America that is going to simply publish that because they would be liable for legal action. So if he gets his way, then it forces these social media platforms to hold him responsible and probably block him, right?
I mean, I would say that if you get rid of Section 230, you can't have a Twitter. I just don't see, I mean, if Twitter's going to be responsible for whatever anybody posts to it, you just can't have it. And, you know, this is why Ted Cruz's arguments are so ridiculous. Congress created this for the express purpose of, you know, you had before Section 230, you had platforms that were in a really tough position because if they did nothing, they could kind of argue that we're just platforms, we're not publishers. But if they did any kind of moderation at all, if they removed child pornography even, right, then someone could come and say, well, you were removing some stuff, so you're a publisher, and so we're going to sue you if you didn't remove these other things. Section 230 was intended to get rid of that perverse incentive. The idea was that you could be the New York Times and you could have your comment section and people could post things and you wouldn't be responsible for what users said. But at the same time, if users were posting terrible, nasty rumors about someone that weren't true, you could catch that and say, well, it isn't true that this person is a murderer. We can take that down and not be punished for it.
Right.
It's a great law. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. It enabled most of the internet as we know it today that's user-generated. It has been tremendously important for free speech online. And so without it, I suppose you would go back to something like the blogging days of yore where everyone had their own single-serve sites and, you know, as someone who loved that era, I do like parts of it, but it would just abolish these giant companies.
Well, you know, I mean, one of the Democratic FCC commissioners said this would turn the Federal Communications Commission into the president's speech police, which I found to be really ironic, because this was something that conservatives, and this would include me, you know, for years we accused people on the left of wanting to bring back the speech police by restoring the fairness doctrine. You know, the Republicans were passionately opposed to any sort of federal regulation that would have targeted talk radio. I mean, one of the reasons why the right is so opposed to campaign finance reform is because, you know, they couch it in free speech terms, you know, that because money is speech. And so this has been a big thing. And now suddenly to flip around. Well, and by the way, here's the other thing. You know, when it comes to, you know, florists and bakers, I mean, didn't conservatives say that conservative businesses should choose who they do business with and that they could be free to decline to display liberal messages? Well, Trump's now saying that these private companies, and Twitter is a private company, you know, should have to be totally neutral conduits of whatever message. So it's the exact opposite position they took. Not to mention the vast expansion of the administrative state, the attack on property rights, et cetera. So it's kind of a head spinning moment. But of course, look, there's no way that he's actually going to be able to do much about it. There's no guarantee that the FTC or the FCC would do anything. If they did, there would be court challenges to this. We still do have a First Amendment. you know, this may rile up his base, but I do wonder if, in fact, this does, I think your point is great, that it reinforces the fact that he's, you know, President Tweety. And when people begin to realize that here you have the president who wants to use the federal government to go after speech he does not like, that he's attacking the internet, that's sort of kicking over a hive, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, watching his feed in the last few days, it's, you know, Section 230, Obamagate, China, these things are all in all caps, and it just seems like he's throwing a bunch of stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks and, you know, maybe testing out what his campaign themes are going to be. If that's the case, I just can't believe that this Twitter thing is going to be one of them. But I will, it will be curious to see how Twitter responds to his tweets going forward, because now they've started saying, well, some of these things are false. And man, we know there's going to be no shortage of those from Trump in coming days if the last 3 years are any indication. So,
well, and this morning we got a little bit of an indication because at least on one level, he was clearly trying to intimidate them. And it's kind of, you know, scorched earth policy, make sure you don't mess with my stuff. And then the very next day, what does Twitter do? Says that the president's tweet about shooting looters violates the terms of contract. So there was an indication that they're not pushing back. By the way, I think one of the good pieces of news, at least so far, has been that there have been conservatives who've pushed back. U.S. Chamber of Commerce, very strong statement about this. Mike Lee says this is a terrible precedent. You want to keep government away from this, you know. National Review has a piece talking about the illiberal internet fairness doctrine. You have the Competitive Enterprise Institute saying what a terrible idea. So at least there's this is not one of those cases where everyone has immediately fallen into line, and I think that's probably a good thing. Okay, speaking of distractions, and we're sort of back to Twitter here, and I don't know how else you avoid being distracted. This whole story about Joe Scarborough is so extraordinary to me. It was on TV yesterday, and I said this it's almost like we're in a laboratory experiment to see how far is conservative media and the Republican Party willing to go to look the other way with Donald Trump. When you have the president of the United States taking time out during a pandemic and an economic crisis, and now massive racial disturbances, urban disturbances, to imply that one of his media critics might have murdered a young woman years ago. And even when that woman, young woman's family pleads, please stop, you know, obviously he's inflicting pain on that family, he keeps doubling down and keeps using even the White House podium to do it. And I was on a segment yesterday, you'll find this interesting, Connor, where they were saying, well, at least now some Republicans are pushing back. I mean, the Washington Examiner wrote an editorial, New York Post had an editorial, Wall Street Journal had an editorial, and look, Liz Cheney and Mitt Romney are pushing back. And my response, because I had just read your piece in The Atlantic, and I said, yeah, you've listed every conservative in America that's spoken publicly on this. Where are the rest of them? So you had the idea of contacting all of the Republicans from Florida, where Joe Scarborough used to be a Republican congressman. Have you gotten any response whatsoever?
Nothing from any of the members of Congress. There were a couple. There was one. You know, I also contacted people in the county Republican parties in the counties that his district encompassed. I think it was five counties. It might have been four. And there were three or four email addresses on each one for the officers of these parties. And one person got back to me before the article published. One person got back to me after. They were both defending Trump, more or less.
Really?
With kind of conspiratorial, oh, well, you don't understand the panhandle, all kinds of crazy stuff goes on down here. I'm not saying I know anything about this in particular, but, you know, I've seen things just like this. And I would, and I said to the guy that I talked to, so you've seen Republicans murdering people? Tell me more about that. Oh, well, I'm not saying that I've seen anything like that. I would, of course, go to the FBI, you know, and, you know, I pushed this guy on, tell me, you know, what if this was happening to you?
Yeah.
This wouldn't be upsetting to you? And, you know, he came to see my point, I could tell, but wasn't willing to say anything against Trump and kept saying, well, you know, it's fair because he keeps getting hit by this guy in all these unfair ways, and he's just hitting back. That's the explanation. Wow. And you say, well, what about the family that's getting caught in this collateral damage? You don't have to care about Scarborough. What about this widower? And he, oh, well, I don't know anything about that. Yeah.
In other words, he didn't want to think about that. I mean, so exactly. the nihilism of this, well, if he gets hit, he can hit back. That's,
and the nihilism, the incredible, you know, we talked about Rush Limbaugh already.
I want to get to that, yeah.
There's this Rush Limbaugh clip where Rush Limbaugh is ostensibly defending Trump and saying, oh, these naive media types who are complaining about this, they don't understand the genius of Trump. He doesn't really believe this. He's just saying it cynically. Like, this is your defense of him?
Yeah,
It's just nakedly endorsing the most abhorrent kind of behavior, taking glee in it.
Okay, you know, this has become almost like the background noise of our time. So it's worth just like thinking about this for a moment, because I was struck by this as well. Just the pure cynicism and sophistry of Limbaugh's analysis, which, by the way, you know, he may be right because he thinks in behaves in many ways like Donald Trump, which is the willingness to throw something out, whether or not it's true or not, to the, well, some people say that you have sex with zoo animals, you know, and you beat baby seals to death with baby, you know, whales. I'm not saying that necessarily, but it's out there. And so you have that sort of dishonest smear without trying to take responsibility. And also the, you know, Limbaugh's suggestion that the president is just having fun with all the moralizers. I mean, look, the cruelty is what I think takes people's breath away. And then you have Rush Limbaugh saying that it's the subtle cleverness, this four-dimensional chess. But, you know, Connor, you've been writing about Limbaugh for many, many years. This is kind of vintage Limbaugh. It's just sort of, you know, maybe a little bit on steroids, but he's been doing this shit for a long time, hasn't he?
He has. I guess what strikes me about both Trump and Limbaugh and the things that they do, for any individual thing that they haven't done yet, if you were to describe to someone, to a conservative, and say, you know what kind of person Limbaugh is? He's the kind of person who would do this. He's the kind of person who would defend the naked nihilism. Trump is the kind of person who would accuse someone of murder knowing that it was incorrect. And Limbaugh is the kind of person who would gleefully, if it hadn't happened yet, conservatives would be, how dare you? How dare you say that, right? And then once it happened, they defend it every time.
Yeah, and you really every time.
You really couldn't, in 2014, if you would have described to the typical Republican who now supports Trump and said, this is the kind of president your party is going to elect, and you described 10 or 12 of the more egregious things, they would be outraged and say, and I would have agreed with them at the time. I would have said, come on.
Me too.
The GOP is not that bad. But here we are. And you just wonder, is there any limit to it? And that's the scary part, is it isn't clear if there is.
No, I think we've tested that. You know, well, what if there was a national disaster? It cost 100,000 lives. Well, they wouldn't go along with, well, you know, again, play the game, all of the things that they've been willing to go along with. And I think you're seeing that a lot of them are in too deep. But, you know, this couldn't have happened without Limbaugh. I mean, I know there's a lot of things. The dysfunction is very, very deep. But he all along has created this sort of mental attitude that, you know, that that this sort of thing is acceptable. In fact, right before that we started this, I was mentioning you're on page 9 of my book, where you know, long before Trump burst upon the scene, Connor Friedersdorf wrote in The Atlantic, hugely popular intellectual leaders abandoned the most basic norms of decency. As when Mark Levin screamed at a caller that her husband should shoot himself, stoked racial tensions, as when Rush Limbaugh avowed that in President Obama's America, folks think white kids deserve to get beat up by black kids on buses and indulge paranoid conspiracy theories, as when Roger Ailes aired month after month of Glenn Beck's chalkboard monologues. And you wrote that back long before Donald Trump. So they were laying the groundwork for this. So I have found it intensely shocking to see the Republican Party and the conservative movement go along with Donald Trump. But the reality is that a lot of this stuff was going on years before, and Rush Limbaugh is right at the center of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when Sarah Palin first came on the scene, I wrote a piece. I think the headline was "The Politics of Schadenfreude." The basic idea was just that it was a politics oriented around driving other people crazy rather than any positive vision. And, you know, you saw this in Andrew Breitbart, too. He had a politics that was all about channeling what he thought of as righteous indignation and being against the media and the left much more than for anything. And when that's your orientation, when you're not really for anything, you're just against, you start behaving terribly because you conceive of the country as these rival camps and you focus on all of the worst stuff that the other camp does. And meanwhile, most Americans are sitting on the sidelines saying, hey, wait a minute, you may think that that other rival camp did terrible things and maybe they did, but we're all not Team X and Team Y. There's 350 million of us, and most of us are on neither team. So it's just such a destructive force that has taken over one political party and has, more than I'm comfortable with in the other political party.
You know. Now that you mentioned this, I'm trying to remember when the phrase "liberal tears" became a thing. You know, and the delight in causing liberal tears. And or that there would be a victory or for the right or a defeat for the left, and the basking in the glory of hippie tears, that sort of thing, and that became morphed into anything that triggers the libs is fun. It's all about the lulls. The other thing that Limbaugh, I think, brought to the table was the cynicism. I think you and I were talking about this right before we started the podcast. The number of times that he has basically admitted, you know, guys, I never believed this. I told you this for years. I carried water for this group or this idea. But, you know, all along, I knew it wasn't true. And I don't actually care that it wasn't true. And you shouldn't care that it wasn't true either. And that's also a habit of mind that I think that we see a lot of these days.
Yes, it's a kind of... it's a kind of disrespect shown toward the audience. And I never quite understand why the audience doesn't get more upset about it. But it's a mystery I'll probably never solve.
No, and the fact is that by the end of the 2016 campaign, Rush Limbaugh was essentially saying, conservatism has failed. It's not about conservatism. Donald Trump's not a conservative. In fact, I'm not going to even call my show the Institute for Conservative Learning anymore. But I suppose to a certain extent, you could give him credit. Okay, here's a mystery, and maybe you could help me or maybe not. And maybe there's no answer to it. But I would think that most human beings, when they are faced with their own mortality at the very end of their lives, when they have had the honors that they would have dreamed of all of their life, would be thinking about their legacy. But Limbaugh seems, rather than say moderating his tone, he's actually bottoming out at the moment that other people would be thinking, hey, I want to look back on my life and think about, you know, the honor that I upheld, the good things that I did. So, what do you think psychologically is going on in his mind? Is it the Medal of Freedom meant so much to him? He's just going to do anything at all to carry water.
He certainly has always been motivated by Medal of Freedom like things. You see past Republican presidents very consciously inviting him to the White House, knowing that it will have this effect. Jim Fallows wrote about this years ago, I think, with the first President Bush. Beyond that, though, beyond liking those kinds of accolades and having a kind of simultaneous inferiority complex and arrogance that are blending in these weird ways, I don't know. I guess the only other point I would make about this psychology running through Limbaugh and Breitbart and Palin and all the people we've been talking about is it's not even as new as all them. I don't know if you know the Randy Newman album, Good Old Boys, mm-hmm. and there's that first song. I think the song is called Rednecks, and it starts, and excuse the language, but it's, you know, it's the narrator of the song, and he's saying, "Last night I saw Lester Maddox on a TV show with some smart-ass New York Jew, and the Jew laughed at Lester Maddox, and the audience laughed at Lester Maddox too. Well, he may be a fool, but he's our fool. If they think they're better than him, they're wrong." And that's, you know, that's Randy Newman channeling this character in the South. So clearly the same psychology existed then. And you can see it in, you know, you can see it, the same psychology in Archie Bunker, right? This kind of oppositional, he may be a fool, but he's our fool kind of attitude isn't so different from let's own the libs and liberal tears.
Well, right. And you turn it around, and the reality is that the left has a smugness problem that they're not willing to acknowledge.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Talk to me about that.
It's a... it's an orientation of talking to everyone through the media as if the thing to do is explain how people ought to feel and what and to reify the enlightened position, right? And I have no objection ever to someone making a forthright argument, a critical argument, a scathing critique even. What I object to is a kind of insular conversation where people aren't engaging it for the sake of debate or truth-seeking. They're just doing norm policing. They're just doing a kind of elite manners and not recognizing the degree to which they're behaving in the way of being the host of a fancy dinner where there's all kinds of different kinds of silverware and someone coming in and being unfamiliar with what to use for the first course and everyone gasping at them as if they've committed a moral affront. And I say this as someone who thinks that there are moral affronts that one should gasp at, but we've gotten to the point, well, I mean, it's right. It's buried into the phrase microaggressions, right? That's the point we're at where anything that anyone says can be twisted with the right terminology into some offense that they're going to get attacked by. And, you know, to live in a world of social media, whether you're on the right, left, center, anywhere, is to just have all the people who disagree with you able to attack you and to experience the worst of them.
Well, so. and to despise you and to have contempt for you. And I think this has been a huge element. And a lot of the supporters of Donald Trump know that they are despised, that they are looked down upon by others. And so there is a huge politics of resentment. And by the way, they're not wrong about that. I mean, they're not wrong that they are looked down upon and despised, which makes, again, very, very hard to appeal to sort of common ground or to shared norms.
Yeah, no, I think that that's right. And the only thing that I tell them when they say, well, these people despise me is, look, first, you probably underestimate the number of Americans who are thinking of you at all. I think everyone does on every side. And also, look, this disdain, I lament it wherever it happens. I don't think that Trump supporters or Hillary Clinton supporters are uniformly bad. I think most of them are good people. But at this point, we're not in 1950 where there's a few television networks and National Review's about to start, and that's the media landscape. The disdain for liberals on national platforms, right? with millions of viewers. And the disdain for conservatives on national platforms with millions of viewers, I don't know if it's exactly symmetrical, but I certainly know a lot of conservatives who talk with utter disdain about anyone who is a liberal. And
no question.
So the idea that there is some one-sided bullying that justifies throwing one's hands up and descending into nihilism is, it's just a kind of victimhood culture that conservatives decry anytime they see anyone else indulging in it.
Well, this has been fascinating to me, you know, as somebody that wrote about victimization back in the 1990s, to watch how the, you know, when I wrote about the nation of victims, it was generally on the left. But now to watch the way the right has embraced victimization and how central it is to their appeal, that we are the victims, that we are not responsible for our problems. The other side hates us. They're doing this stuff. But of course, that gives you license. That gives you license to do any. If you can convince yourself that the other side is completely malign, has no ethics, has no morals, hates you, hates God, hates the country, then you then become justified in doing almost anything or believing almost anything. And I think that's where we're at.
Yeah, well, and what better avatars is the apotheosis of this phenomenon than President Trump, President of the United States, billionaire, standing, giving a Presidential Medal of Freedom to Rush Limbaugh, multimillionaire, nationally syndicated media personality, and these two coastal dwelling elites thinking of themselves as put upon victims who are just so unfairly bullied all the time.
See, Dossie, if Connor, if you would have written that screenplay back in 2014, no, the producers would have said, this is over the top. Can you make it more realistic? I mean, Donald Trump is president. Give me the Medal of Freedom. I mean, it is like this dystopian, bizarro cartoon version.
It is literally a cartoon. A Simpsons episode was the only place where you saw Trump as president.
Oh, I know. It is strange times indeed. Well, Connor Friedersdorf, I love reading your stuff. I hope you can you do it. I hope things are going to be okay at the Atlantic, despite the president's attacks and the various.
Yeah, well, I think we probably got a few subscriptions from it, and you know he isn't going to be around forever. So I will be particularly fascinated to talk to you and hear your insights when it's time to figure out what the Republicans do next.
Boy, and you know what? And I'm fascinated to hear my thoughts about that too. Really. Connor Friedersdorf from The Atlantic, thanks so much for joining us on the Bulwark Podcast.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to this weekend's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again.